And welcome, everybody. Here we are on Off the Hook Overtime on YouTube, on the internet, not on the radio. We all make it. Alex, you there?
I am here.
Kyle?
Hello.
You there?
Hello.
Okay, and apparently I'm here as well. Okay, so let's continue this conversation about the Colonial Pipeline, because it really is an interesting story, and so much we can learn from it. I have this statement from the group called DarkSide, who apparently was the group behind the ransomware attack. DarkSide hacker gang. Not sure how accurate any of this is. Could be one person. It could be somebody from anywhere. It could be somebody employed at Colonial, for all you know. Anything's possible. But according to Boston-based Cyber Reason, DarkSide is an organized group of hackers set up along the ransomware as a service business model, which means that DarkSide hackers develop and market ransomware hacking tools and sell them to other criminals who then carry out attacks. That's a living, isn't it? Think of it as the evil twin of a Silicon Valley software startup. Well, come on, most of them are evil to start with anyway, so I don't know. Basically, what they said was, the statement they issued, we are apolitical. God forbid we get dragged into politics. Yeah, we'll steal millions of dollars. That's not a problem, but politics leave us out. Yeah, we are apolitical. We do not participate in geopolitics. Do not need to tie us with a defined government and look for our motives. Our goal is to make money and not creating problems for society. From today, we introduce moderation and check each company that our partners want to encrypt to avoid social consequences in the future. What does that mean? They just don't want the publicity? Social consequences? There's always going to be social consequences.
Well, when there's social consequences, they often are precursors to the involvement of law enforcement.
Ah.
What they ultimately want to avoid is is law enforcement being chased down by the FBI and extradited to the United States.
Well, according to this group, Cyber Reason, they're not the cyber attackers. They're the security people. They report that DarkSide has a perverse desire to appear ethical, even posting its own code of conduct for it. I'm sorry, ransomware people have codes of conduct. It's important to be inclusive, I guess, right? We include all organizations and businesses in our attacks.
So
we don't discriminate.
You know, the flip side of having a code of conduct, you have to think about it from the perspective of the victim as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you know that you've been targeted by DarkSide, they have a code of conduct, they may have reputation scores. I mean, some of these ransomware gangs, especially on darknet forums and things, they get rated on how well their decryption tools work, whether you can trust them to decrypt the data.
Hang on. They get what? There's a Yelp review for these guys? Where are they rated?
Similarly, in that sense, but absolutely, there are all different types of forums that you can rate. Some of them they're not necessarily all on the dark web, but you can get an assessment of which ransomware gang you can trust, which one has a reputation for just taking the money and running.
But
which ones are going to?
Alex, it's not like you can just take your ransomware encrypted files elsewhere, right? They're the ones that chose you. If anything, you should have the rating for having bad security. But if they have a bad rating, what are your options? You can't just go to a different gang.
The ratings are there to encourage people to pay, right? And the same thing with the code of conduct. If you have this code of conduct, you seem like you've got some modicum of ethics. You're encrypting somebody else's files and demanding a ransom for it. So you don't have a large amount of scruples, but you do want to have a good reputation as a ransomware gang
I'm having trouble with this. Who makes the reviews? We were targeted by DarkSide, and they were the most pleasant and easy to talk to people who guided us through every step of the way as we paid the millions of dollars. Who writes the reviews to give them the reputation that they're easy to work with and trustworthy? Who does that?
Sometimes it's a victim. Sometimes the lawyers. A lot of law firms get involved when there's ransomware payments as well. There's lots of us, and also insurance companies as well, have an interest in this particular data, because insurance companies are oftentimes the ones on the hook for paying the ransomware.
Hang on, you're a lawyer, and you're kind of involved in this. Are you saying you've written reviews rating ransomware?
I have reviews of ransomware gangs. No, that I have not done. I've dealt with ransomware, but I've never written a review. But you know, I've seen reviews of particular gangs, and look, and it is very similar. But the whole point here is to add an air of legitimacy to the operation, so that the victim has some level of faith that when they pay that $1 million or $500,000 or $5 million, whatever the ransom is, that they're going to get what they're paying for, which is namely their data back and confidentiality these days. Because like I mentioned, you know, during the ordinary off-the-hook program, it's not just about restoring from a backup anymore. It's also trying to prevent the ransomware gang from releasing your data out to the public.
Mm-hmm. Which is, again, something you can never be sure of. Yeah, they can unlock your data. You can get access to it again, but they have access to it. And they could keep a copy, and they could do something, you know, ransomware with a monthly payment, kind of like the BAI buddy system, except really bad. And
you know, look, that's a scary thought, because it's probably, you know, actually somewhat brilliant, and then to have a ransomware buddy system,
yeah,
like that.
Ransom buddy is what you call it, and that's my phrase. You can't just use that, all right? So
I'm sure ransombuddy.com is going to be registered at any moment now.
And if it is, there's going to be some negotiation taking place, believe me.
Yeah, no doubt. But I want to make one other point, though, before we move on from this, too, which is that, okay, this is Colonial Pipeline that was targeted. It was an infrastructure company. Right? I mean, obviously, they deal with their pipeline. It's in the name, right? So for DarkSide to come out and say, we didn't really know the implications here, means that they – you know, they're not doing their due diligence at all. I mean, you can go to their website and see what they do. But one thing that I want to mention, too, is I have been predicting for a long period of time now that these ransomware events are going to be start targeting other infrastructure-related companies. And I'll tell you, a very good indication that this was forthcoming is I have been tracking a particular group of criminals since the end of 2018. And this is a group that they originally targeted a healthcare client of mine, and it was a very slick credentials harvesting attack. I went down the rabbit hole because I was sort of obsessed with this attack. It was really good. It used the DNS in a very fascinating way, very believable, and I started to make assumptions about where I could track and trace this particular group, scanned a massive amount of data to find other attacks that they had launched. And then I've now traced them back. 6 years. They started this in 2015, and I have data on over 1,700 attacks that this one particular group has launched. For they were all credentials harvesting attacks. A massive amount of these companies are in critical infrastructure in the United States. Some of the other companies are in the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. But a huge amount, and by huge amount, I mean probably about 98-99% of them, were in the United States. And a good number of those related to oil and gas. And I would say we saw the targeting of probably between a half a dozen and a dozen other pipelines by this particular group. And what this means, though, is that these attacks that are happening now are not, let's say, credentials harvesting or a phishing attack. Those are attacks that may not be related to a ransomware event that happens next week. The attacks that happened in the past are arguably more important to know about and arguably more important to have been able to defend against than the ones that are happening at the moment. Because let's say even a small portion of these attacks that we had witnessed on a massive amount of infrastructure-related targets were effective. That means that there were aliens inside those networks. There are criminals inside those networks. They probably, those credentials may have been passed around. They may have established persistence in all different segments of their particular network. They may be exploiting their network. They may be stealing data. They may be about to launch a ransomware event. But it's that access in the past that can be exploited for a present purpose that is really, really scary. Another really good, example of this is last year when I detected, and it was a huge news story, the attack, a very highly sophisticated spear phishing attack that wound up being attributed to South Korea on the World Health Organization on March 13th, 2020. You know, right at the height of the hysteria about the pandemic, everything's kicking off. But the way in which I was able to detect that, and this was never reported in the media, despite me saying it many, many times, it never made it into any of the stories that reported on this. is that the reason why I was able to detect that attack was because I had seen that particular group target the World Health Organization about a half a dozen times in the past. And even though we're able to make the appropriate noises and that the World Health Organization attack was not successful, but what about those attacks in the past? Those are the ones that really, really worry me. Not when everybody is on high alert right now, but if there is persistence inside your network, it's very difficult to get sophisticated cyber adversaries out.
Very true.
I'll stop.
Very true. No, it's a well thought out point and something that I think a lot of us need to learn. Let me continue with what we heard about DarkSide with their code of conduct. They've posted their own code of conduct for its customers, telling them who and what targets are acceptable to attack. Protected organizations not to be harmed include hospitals, hospices, schools, universities, nonprofit organizations, and government agencies. Also apparently protected are entities based in former Soviet countries. So I guess the ones to be worried are the for-profit companies in English-speaking countries, and that's certainly what this pipeline company was categorized as. I got to say though, you know, with all the effort that activists have taken to shut down pipelines, these guys did it pretty efficiently and quickly. So I don't know. I'm kind of I've got mixed feelings about this. I don't think they should be so quick to apologize for affecting this particular organization. Seems like, you know, a well thought out target, but there's certainly things that any company, any organization can do to protect itself against this sort of attack. And you have to have decent security. You have to have security, period. And you have to obviously keep backups, but again, that doesn't keep you from having people infiltrate your network and expose your private data. There are so many companies that just aren't getting this right. And I think that's something that we will never see the end of as long as human beings are somehow responsible. Actually, you know, I saw a study about passwords and how the complex passwords actually aren't always the most secure passwords. They say passwords comprising complex strings of numbers and characters are hard to remember but relatively easy to hack. That's according to research. For a long time, password strength was measured by how complex a password was, such as whether it included both upper and lowercase characters, numbers, special characters like ampersands, dollar signs. But security experts are increasingly moving away from these complex passwords to ones that seem more simple but are actually harder for intruders to crack. Researchers from James Cook University found users were far more likely to engage in unsafe cybersecurity behavior if forced to keep creating complex passwords by overzealous IT managers. And I think we've all experienced this on some, like, for instance, logging into banks. I occasionally log into my bank account. Not often, but occasionally. And almost every time, they've changed their requirements for passwords, and they're scolding me for having an insecure password that they told me to implement last time. But now they've changed, and they added an extra character. And you can't use certain characters, and you have to have a certain number of numbers, and it's all very annoying, and I don't think it really adds much to security. Associate Professor Roberto Dillon conducted a survey in which users were asked to create increasingly complex passwords. Then, in a separate survey, they were asked about their usual password habits online. He said that in 75% of cases, users used various strategies to remember passwords, many of which compromised their data security. The most popular strategy, I think we can all guess what this is, using the same password from multiple sites. Our results confirm that the tougher the constraints on creating the passwords, the safer users feel with their information. However, the results show that a large number of restrictions can frustrate users. Professor Dillon said the research confirmed what was becoming mainstream theory among data security experts. When it comes to passwords, complex is not always better. One of the most common ways to crack a password is the brute force method, where a hacker sets up a computer program to rapidly guess as many character combinations as it can until it guesses the password. And as a result, many companies insist that their employees use complex passwords because if they're still relatively short, they can be cracked. So instead of an extremely complex but relatively short password, for example, capital T, lowercase v, uppercase U, 4, uppercase E, pound sign, lowercase k, ampersand. Instead of using that, use something like sunlight autumn leaves, one word. This is easy to remember, but long enough to hinder brute force hacking attacks. Of course, a dictionary attack might get that if it knew where the word began and ended. At the same time, providers should avoid adding several restrictions, as it makes it more likely for users to resort to workarounds that compromise security. And that's what people will do. They'll write their password down somewhere so that they always have it, or they'll just cut and paste it from something, and as we said, use it in many, many places. So, longer and more complex isn't always better, because we're humans and we make mistakes.
It's the law of unintended consequences here, right? A security policy that, in an unintended fashion, but in a foreseeable way, creates a security risk. I mean, certainly not the first time that has happened. But it is fascinating, though. I mean, the idea of using longer passwords that are easy to remember, all of these things, I think can be avoided by using some kind of password vault system as well, right? Some kind of password locking system, one password or last pass, things like that.
I've never actually used something like that, but how does that work? You're storing all your passwords where?
In a single vault.
And what kind of vault is this? It's a virtual vault, I take it.
Yeah, it's a virtual vault.
And it has a password, right?
That's correct.
So what happens if somebody guesses that password?
Well, they would have to have the vault in order to get access to the password.
How do they get the vault?
They'd probably have to compromise your device in order to do that.
It sounds like if I have one password, I can get into the vault and then have access to all your passwords.
Possibly, but all of those passwords are going to be unique going to all these other sites, right? So at least you have a greater amount of security on every one of those individual sites. Certainly, if your password vault is compromised, if your device is compromised, you've got problems, and you've got big problems. You're absolutely right about that.
Well, wouldn't that vault tell me where the passwords went to, what systems they matched up with?
Yeah, it would, absolutely.
So I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this. Yeah, it seems like a good idea, but it also seems like if you make a mistake or if somebody guesses something, you could be a lot more screwed than if you just lost one password.
Well, but it prevents the very common security vulnerabilities like reusing passwords from site to site to site. You're going to get out of that rut, or using variations on a theme. Right? Or, you find that you've got so many passwords that were subject to, let's say, the LinkedIn breach, the Yahoo breach, the OPM, whatever it was, right? There's so many of our passwords that are out there. This gets you out of using any variation of a theme on any of those passwords that were breached.
No, I get that, but you have to access the vault at some point. And if somebody is eavesdropping on you doing that, then they have access to your vault, and then they have access to all your passwords, right?
Yeah, but it's not that simple to access the vault itself, right? I mean, you would need to. It's not the kind of thing that is going to be accessible over the internet to get all of these particular passwords. You need to be on the device.
Okay, so that's what I need to understand. So it's actually attached to a device.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my understanding of how it all works. I could be slightly different. I think.
And this device is not on your network, I take it.
It could be on the network.
Your expression tells me that it is on the network. So if somebody gains access to your network, could they then get access to your device, i.e. the vault?
Possibly. But let's say your device is your phone, right? It's going to be very difficult, especially if you're running an iPhone, in order to compromise the security of that.
Well, if I lose my phone, which many people do, or lend my phone to somebody for a second and they do something bad, I don't know. You have to think, in the worst possible terms.
Yeah, Alex, what if they're good at micro-soldering?
They could do that, too.
Take your phone apart.
Wow.
Did you think of that?
there's all kinds of things. I mean, they could be monitoring for magnetic emissions, things like that. And there's been breaches of password vaults or password managers in the past as well.
And what happens if you lose access to it somehow, which I think is probably more likely?
Yeah, then you need to go back to Mt. Gox and ask for your Bitcoin.
What if I come into your office and steal your device off your network and you don't have it anymore? How do you get your passwords back?
Then you're in a world of hurt, perhaps.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I mean, look, like any kind of situation where you're you forget your password, the password reset function is what you would rely on. But the those have their own security vulnerabilities as well.
Have either of you used the browser password managers from any of the major web browsers?
I don't trust my browser, so no.
You don't?
No, I don't. Yeah, exactly.
Have you ever used the – well, if you have, and I suspect that's probably the closest thing to a password manager that our typical listener would interface with, because it behaves kind of like an independent password manager, but it's built into a lot of the browsers. I know Firefox has it. And works pretty well, and in fact suggests making you a password. I think it generates, randomly generates a password for you, and those are long and varied. So kind of a combination of the two things the article mentioned, like really long and really crazy. So I wonder if some of those passwords will change.
You're going to have to put it somewhere if you want to remember it. You're going to have to put that password in a file or something, and it's you know, that's the security hole.
Well, that's the password generator.
Okay.
But you're right. It is stored. I think it's stored in a secure way within your user settings for the browser on your machine. Mm-hmm. And there's like a master control password so that you can't interface with any of the stored passwords with that, which is exactly like how a wallet works. I'm just curious if any listeners use that. You obviously don't have to – it's not all or nothing. Like, you can pick and choose how you do different things for different sites. Maybe the threat for one site is different and distinct from another, or an application you're using – needs really special security, or whatever it is, you don't have to use it exactly the way it's sort of sold or marketed. And what I'm saying is, like, maybe sites you don't really care that much about, you can keep track of them that way. It's a cool thing to learn how to use, even if you're not using it for, like, your bank or your personal stuff, which I would be reluctant to use something like that for really stuff that I want secured.
We got an email the other day, actually. I wanted to read this to oth@2600.com. The subject, your response needed now. So it seemed pretty important. That's why I grabbed it immediately. And it came – here's the weird part. Alex, this is important. This is important. I see you're distracted. You should pay attention to this. This is very important. It came from oth@2600.com. So it was sent to oth@2600.com, but it came from oth@2600.com. How is that possible? It came from us.
The reply to was probably different than the sender.
No, it's from oth, Alex. It came from us, all right? So listen carefully to what they say to us. Have you recently noticed that I've emailed you from your account? Yes. This simply means that I have total access to your device for the last couple of months. I've been watching you. Still wondering how is that possible? Yeah, I am. Well, you have been infected with malware originating from an adult website that you visited and some movies streaming download site. You may not be familiar with this, but I'll try explaining it to you. With help of the Trojan virus, I have complete access. Trojan virus is capitalized, by the way. I have complete access to a PC or any devices. This simply means I can see you at any time and shut down and restart your PC. And you know, my PC has been shutting down and restarting. I was told that was just Windows 10, but no, apparently it's this guy. I can easily turn on your screen by simply turning on your camera and microphone without you even noticing it. Again, I thought that was Windows 10, but it's not. In addition, I've also got access to your contacts list and all your correspondence. You may be asking yourself, but my PC has an active antivirus. How is this even possible? Again, Windows 10. Why didn't I receive any notification? Well, the answer is simple. My malware uses drivers. His malware uses drivers. Why didn't we think of this? When I update the signatures every 4 hours, making it undetectable, and hence keeping your antivirus silent. I have a video of you, well, I don't want to say what it has a video of any of us doing, but it involves a video and involves how we were reacting to the video. And okay, wondering how bad this could get. With just a single click of my mouse, this video can be sent to all your social networks and email contacts. Is there nothing that can be done? Well, if you ever wish us to wipe out all your details that we have got, all you have to do to prevent this from happening is transfer bitcoins worth $1,850 in bit, and smart not to say how many bitcoins because the number has been dropping recently. And but if you say $1,850, then I've got to do the calculation and figure it out. Send Bitcoin to the below address. And if you don't know this, search how to buy Bitcoin on Google or YouTube or Pax Full of Coinbase. They have a support desk that's open around the clock. And here's the Bitcoin address. I'm not going to read it on the air, but you know what? I did look it up because you can see all the transactions that go to and from a Bitcoin address. And I saw there were four transactions. One, and this is in current day Bitcoin value, one was a deposit of about $7, followed by a withdrawal of that same amount, and then the next one was for about $12, again followed by a withdrawal of that exact amount. So sounds like somebody was just testing it, but no $1,850 in deposits. So nobody else fell for this. But it concludes with this. Now you have 48 hours to make a payment. The moment we receive the transaction, I'm going to wipe out these movies and everything completely, and you will never hear from me anymore. You'll hear from somebody else. Or else, please be sure that the evidence will be sent out to all your contacts, including relatives, coworkers, Facebook, and so forth, and your private information on your device will share public. Well said. This kind of thing, you know, I imagine many of our listeners have also received email like this and had the crap scared out of them, thinking that because it came from their address, you know, it has to be proof that they have access to something they shouldn't have access to. And as you said, Alex, at the beginning, when you ruined the entire thing by saying what they actually did, the reply to address, yes, in fact, was changed. And if you look at the full headers, you'll see where it actually came from, which is probably some site from far away someplace, which is no doubt masked as well. So it's not the actual username that that sent it. But the fact of the matter is, it's not real. It's not real. You should never fall for something like this. You should never click on any links that are included in this email. These things go out all the time. And fortunately, most people don't fall for them. But it's kind of like ransomware, except that your files aren't being encrypted and kept from you. You're just being scared into thinking that somebody has access when, in all likelihood, they don't.
Well, it's an interesting psychological pivot point, too, to receive an email from your own account. You know, it, most people think, oh, my God, you know, this proves, of course, that they have access to my account. You know, how else could they possibly do this? But, you know, people have been spoofing emails since the SMTP protocol existed. I mean, it's just the way that email works, the way the protocols work, they were designed for interoperability. They weren't necessarily designed for security, which is why literally every single day there are billions and billions of spoofed emails.
Thank you, Carl Sagan, for that.
Yeah, no doubt. But this becomes problematic in the context of something like a global health crisis, though, because it allows people to impersonate, let's say, politicians, the CDC, the World Health Organization, and then spread misinformation through email or spread some kind of scam, you know, about, let's say, a vaccine or, you know, clicking on the site for a vaccine appointment, whatever it is, you know, that can then deploy malware to a local system. There's all different there's a lot of problems that arise from spoofed emails being used in really creative and malicious ways. And I think the one that you read, Emmanuel, was a very creative and malicious use of a spoofed email. I mean, this is something I remember doing, spoofing emails with SMTP and false way back in the 90s.
Telnetting to port 25.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yep, you remember this. It was fun, and you can still do it. But there are things out there now that will help to prevent this from happening within your own organization, namely the SPF, something called the Sender Policy Framework. When you combine that with something called DMARC, it drastically reduces the amount of spoofed email messages that one will receive. The problem, though, is that the vast majority of the Internet doesn't have SPF and DMARC configured. And so it causes a lot of emails to bounce. If both parties don't have this configured, it can cause emails to – you can lose a lot of messages. And that's a big problem. And, in fact, this is something specifically that one of our HOPE keynotes this past summer addressed, and that was Flavio Augello, the CISO of the World Health Organization that spoke at HOPE, and one of his upgrades that he's hoping that everybody does, because the World Health Organization was subject to a hell of a lot of email spoofing during the pandemic, is to deploy SPF, the Sender Policy Framework, and DMARC to try to prevent spoofed emails like this from proliferating any further.
Hey, it's half an hour into overtime, and we haven't even given out the phone number yet. Wow.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are we going to take this call?
Oh, yeah.
We have a call?
We've had a call for like a half hour.
I'm sorry, I didn't know we had a call.
I hung up, and then they called back.
Well, they're persistent, as any off-the-hook listener should be.
You should probably see if they're still alive.
Yeah, you got to wave your arms a little bit more. I thought you were just, it's hot, so I thought you were fanning yourself. I'm sorry. Caller, are you still there?
I sure am.
I'm so sorry. I didn't know you were there.
that's okay. I've been listening and patient, and everything that you've been discussing has been important and right on topic. I have some stuff to add on topic, and then if you're patient with me, I have something I want to ask you about off topic. With regard to the Colonial Pipeline situation and DarkSide and supposedly getting out of the ransomware business, Steve Gibson on his Security Now podcast, which is weekly, yesterday was the day of the podcast, touched on this and posted messages that were posted up on the two sites, which make very interesting reading. I'm not sure that anybody should take them at face value. I see no reason. I shouldn't say I see no reason.
What was the gist of it?
There's a lot of pressure that's probably been brought on these ransomware actors.
Oh yeah.
Behind the scenes from the CIA and from the heavy duty governmental entities, not just in the U.S., and they're probably feeling a lot of heat at this point. On the other hand, I don't think anybody can count on them going out of the business.
They became a fat target and in being made an example of, I think.
Right, but I think at this point, whatever they're saying about getting out of the business is either temporary or lip service.
Exactly.
Now, with regard to the discussion you were having about...
Do you have something to say about that first?
Oh, yeah. Before you move on to that, caller, I think you're absolutely right in that sense. And what a lot of these criminal gangs will do is they'll claim that they're disbanding. They hope that gets the heat off of them, at least temporarily. They then resurrect themselves under a new name and a new jurisdiction. You know, but it's the same. Okay. It's basically the old band back together, but just under a new name.
Exactly. Nobody's going anyplace. It's too profitable, and which is something else I wanted to mention that which you kind of touched on. I suspect, and as you were talking about going back and looking at the history on this, I suspect that the ransomware is just another profit center in the operation, and as we know, anything that's Russian that's not government is related to the government, and I suspect that you're talking about setting up backdoors. You're talking about access to complete networks and all kinds of data. Nobody's going to give that up, and I suspect that the ransomware is just kind of a dollar plus cover for other activities that are going on.
Well, that's the best. Pretense for the chaos of exploiting other vulnerabilities, that you have this messy, disruptive, chaotic environment where other stuff can go unnoticed.
Exactly. Which kind of brings us to SolarWinds and what you were saying about persistence. And I have a question about SolarWinds, which you probably don't have an answer to, but I haven't heard anybody speaking to the issue. SolarWinds was a massive, I shouldn't say was, is a massive compromise of entire cyber structures, not simply a system or a network. We're talking, you know, 15, 20,000 network systems. That's a lot of equipment. And once you have this kind of a threat, it does no good. Once it's been established, it does no good to patch the entry point, patching SolarWinds and the Oracle software. They're in. And this was a very sophisticated attack that basically was erasing its own trails. The question that I have is, what's being done to replace all that equipment? Because the only real alternative you have at that point is to trash your hardware and start over.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there's going to be tons of e-waste, metric tons of e-waste as a result of this, and essentially they'll either...
But I don't hear anybody speaking to it.
Right. Either use them in a... What I was going to... No, it's that's the other aspect of this that we could go on and on about. It's the silence. You really do not get a lot of info at all about... and specifically with the international situation versus a private company having a security breach of on the order of what Colonial Pipeline experienced. So, yeah, getting information about that and then geopolitical stuff, any kind of certainty in there is a little bit tough to get that definitive because a lot of the reports will remain classified or... in other words, not be public. And
I haven't even seen any writing being done suggesting that this is something that needs to happen.
Well, yeah, I think what's the mitigation is equipment and building up new networks alongside that are separate and isolating those networks that were affected, probably tearing out 10,000 of the computers, right, leaving 4 or whatever, you know, basically paring them down and eliminating what is essential, pulling off anything, and if you can still use or read the data, keeping it in an isolated sandbox, so to speak, and all of that, I think, is going to go on. It's going to take time, though, even to procure the equipment and change it out and prioritize, too. I think that's a big part of how it would then be budgeted.
Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. And I think the other side of the coin, too, Kohler, is that, you know, on one hand, I think you're right in that, you know, these are devices, they've been compromised. There's always going to be some uncertainty about whether, you know, even after, let's say, formatting the hard drive, reinstalling the OS, perhaps maybe there was something malicious in the firmware, or they made a lateral jump to another machine somewhere in the network. And it's very difficult, but I mean, in any kind of incident, I think you're going to have a similar set of circumstances. But for businesses, it's about risk and mitigating certain risk and accepting other risks. And I think a lot of people were pulling their hair out in the first couple of weeks with the SolarWinds remediation and drips and drabs of data coming out and different IOCs or indicators of compromise that were changing and shifting, and then you would have to go back and begin the search again to determine whether or not you see any of these IOCs. But I think the calculus for many organizations was that if you didn't see these IOCs or any of these indicators of compromise in your system, you didn't notice any unusual activity, nothing bad happened, and then you couple that together with what you're hearing from DHS, that the actual number of systems that were exploited was relatively low compared to all of the systems on which SolarWinds was actually installed. You know, and then you begin to think, like, okay, well, you know, all of that points to this being low risk. And then the fact that there wasn't this massive kind of breach also indicates that the other side on this, the attackers, were very sophisticated, very cautious and conscientious. And those aren't necessarily the hallmarks of criminal gangs. Those are the hallmarks of governments that don't want to get caught and want to keep a low footprint. But so all of that,
if,
I think...
If I can interrupt you for a second, the other side of that is that the attack was in place for many months. Some estimates I've seen suggest perhaps a year or better. And they were very careful about not allowing the attack to be seen, erasing their tracks and erasing any evidence that there was any presence other than what was should have been on the system. So if they're being that careful, and that's why everybody immediately said this is state level hacking. This is not your script kiddies. But this was very carefully done. So how do you know if they're there or not? And at what point does it become national security?
Yeah, and look, I think you're right. These guys, you know, they're good, and any sophisticated adversary is going to have great techniques that are for anti-forensics, right, to prevent their detection, their tracking and tracing. Yeah, Joe, everybody makes mistakes, but, you know, some are better than others. But, you know, look, you're right about that, but I think you have to look at all of the circumstances and come up with a risk rating. You know, what's the risk I'm bringing into my organization by keeping this machine on and within the network, and is it an acceptable risk or is it not? And a lot of organizations would have to accept the risk because it's just too costly not to. But you know, you're absolutely right though. I mean, and this is the problem, is that there has been so much uncertainty about who is exploited, whether you can trust the assessment of the government and DHS and finding that these were very low. I mean, maybe there'll be a further finding 6 months down the road that, in fact, you know, a larger number of companies were exploited through the SolarWinds attack. We just don't know. There are so many, as Rumsfeld would say, known unknowns about this particular incident. And I really think it's going to be – we're going to be peeling back the onion on this probably for at least another year or two. And I don't think that
Are you suggesting that you trust DHS to make that judgment?
I think DHS acts in good faith, but look, you know, like any organization as well, this is not an investigation, I think, that can happen very, very quickly, and there's going to be pieces of the puzzle that are going to be appearing later on in time that can change the entire analysis.
Well, there has to be a will for that to happen, and,
yes,
and that's what worries me, is I'm not sure the will to – well, certainly the will to do that wasn't there prior to January 20th, there seems to be some change going on, and hopefully the institutions within the government will be up to the task, but I am not confident personally.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for calling. Where are you calling from, by the way?
Can I ask you a quick off-topic question?
If you tell us where you're calling from.
Let's just say the lower Hudson Valley.
Okay, that's good enough. Go ahead.
When the station, I won't ask you to discuss any of the politics that are currently going on with the voting and within the station, although you're not on the air now, so I suppose you could.
That's true.
When the station was taken over by the idiot clique that took it over.
Yes, we know who you're talking about.
Funds were appropriated. Accounts were appropriated. And the station was in the middle of a fund drive, just beginning a fund drive at the time, so there was lost opportunity and monies lost there as well, plus a reputational cost for anybody who might have been leaning towards contributing. So the station lost real funds and potential ongoing income.
Correct.
What has been done in terms of trying to claw back the monies that were taken and any potential income that might have been lost through not just civil suits but criminal suits? I mean, we're talking about felony here. We're talking large amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of have a comment about that, but I ask you because there's really nobody else that you can trust to get an answer from.
Well, I don't think any of us are privy to the actual specifics as to how much money was involved and who got access and who lost access, et cetera. I do know that the people supporting WBAI, the local station, won in court, and that's how they're back on the air now, is because of those court rulings, and the people who were behind the attempt to take it over, or the successful attempt for a few weeks at least, they were stripped of their power. They're no longer part of Pacifica. That doesn't mean that there aren't still people in Pacifica that wish for this to succeed and are trying to make it succeed on other levels. I don't have details on if money was lost, how much was lost, if it was restored, if people are being held accountable. These are all good questions.
My fundamental question is were criminal charges brought against these people, and if not, why not?
That's a good question.
And I have a comment about the station asking for money.
Well, Kyle, did you have something to say?
I was just going to add, I seem to recall very early on that getting access back to some of the accounts and management tools, that was very difficult. Mm-hmm. That was a very real consequence of what happened.
My memory.
And strong-arming volunteers to get into an online account for whatever it was. I'm alleging this. I don't know the details, but I do seem to recall that after it had been adjudicated in the station's favor, the local station's favor, it was weeks before the offending parties, I guess, relinquished control back or otherwise cooperated. Yeah, it was not easy, I know, for the station volunteers to fix what was done.
The important thing is that a lot of people stood up and voiced their support and fought really hard on the legal front and on getting word out. And I don't think we should minimize that tremendous accomplishment. Yeah, there are still things that need to be sorted out. We still need some answers, and it might take a while because that's how long it takes in the court system, and there are things I'm not privy to, but it was a victory for the people of New York in getting that station back. And the only thing I really regret, the thing I regret most, is that while we were on all the media outlets that day, all the newspapers, all the TV stations, they all reported that this radio station has been on the air forever. WBAI is going off the air. They didn't correct it when we came back on the air. They made it a fait accompli where we lost and it was over. But a lot of people might never have known that we came back if they didn't tune back to 99.5.
Yeah, that's my memory as well. I had to hunt for the information.
Mm-hmm.
I would leave you with a comment, and we really don't need to take time talking about it, but it's something that I think needs to be said. I will try to say it on the air. I've said it once already with Hop Day. There are very few programs that I feel are of the kind of value that goes back many years. We have too many older people in the community and not enough younger people. But one of my concerns is that there seems to be a conventional wisdom within the station these days that you create programming by raising funds. In reality, the past has shown us it's exactly the opposite. You raise funds by creating programming.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that that's been lost at the moment. And all of these infomercials, and there's a lot of garbage.
Yeah, but if I could step in here, there is one major difference that has taken place over the past year, and I truly support this from the BAI management, where you may have noticed we're not on the air incessantly begging for money. Instead, we get preempted every few weeks for a program that will bring in something. And yeah, it might not be your cup of tea, but we do have to pay the bills. And incessantly having Off the Hook and every other show begging for money and not covering the things that we cover, I think that's pretty detrimental to what we do and what the station sounds like.
I agree, but there has to be another way, because the flooding of the air with these infomercials runs counter to everything that the station has been.
I would love to know what the other way is. My idea is underwriting. I think, BAI has always had a strong position against underwriting. I think it could be done in a way that is palatable, and that could raise a significant sum. And there are other ways, too, but it involves being savvy in the art of raising funds. But I agree, it's not the best sound.
Exactly. That's
it could
where
get
I was going to go with that. I think you're right, and I think by creating excellent programming that will be a magnet to draw people in, people of creativity and intellect, and bringing with that the right public relations message.
Yeah.
That's how you raise funds.
Yeah, we're right there with you. And something that comes to mind in hearing your vision is that what I get from the station now in my experience with it is that we've stabilized in many ways, like having scheduling that is a little bit more predictable because of, as E mentioned, the regular fundraising cycles. I know maybe it feels like there are placeholders and spots that could have better programming, but many of the operational hurdles to foster that environment are actually in really good shape in comparison and in light of over the many half a dozen years I know the station's been in various straits. Having a venue like we have now,
half a dozen decades.
Oh yeah,
I mean it's chronic. It goes back to the church and even before that. You know, one of the worst things that the station ever did as an entity was getting rid of that church.
Well, I don't think they got rid of it. I think Mayor Koch kicked them out of it by imposing a huge tax bill because he didn't like what they said. I think that's how the story went. Go ahead, Koch.
I just wanted to finish by saying that the circumstances are not the circumstances are right for new programming to come in. The venue we have now is a great community center in the studios. What it took to get there, what it took to whether it's staffing after this takeover or fulfillment issues, we've faced it all in as best a way we can, given the dynamics of the situation. You know, the station itself, yeah, it's moved, it's changed, it's morphed. We agree, though, like, there is something missing in nurturing what kind of, I guess, development it takes on the program side to get someone that is starting to kind of figure out radio and move them along to being comfortable enough to trying new things or find really like kind of finding comfort in the station itself. It's there.
That's ready for people to join it.
Yeah,
we have to
support the diversity of our staff and our audience and open up the doors, even though we don't agree completely with what's being spouted on the air. We need to open it up to more young people because that's the future of having a vibrant schedule.
Because we noticed the same
before about too many people who have been with the station for too long. You know,
yeah.
I'm in my mid 70s. I was that when the staff got locked out. I was on the streets demonstrating and at community meetings at Symphony Space and at the court hearings downtown. This goes back, you know, decades, many decades.
Yeah.
And when you listen to people calling in, they're too people with too much gray hair.
It's true.
Where are the 20 and 30 year olds?
It's true. Yeah, and I think there needs to be some dance there of keeping people around because you need those storytellers.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily too many people with gray hair. I think it's not enough people with blue hair. You know, we need more of that.
Yeah.
We need, you know, more of a mix. But I value every one of our listeners as far as, you know, their experience, their stories.
But you have to
be able to listen to others as well. It can't just be about you.
I wasn't
discounting people who have the experience of being with the station all these years. I discovered the station probably in 63 or 64.
Wow.
But where are the younger people?
There has to be,
getting drawn in.
Some letting go and some leading them to taking on some of those
roles.
Hey,
you don't have any tapes of those early years, do you?
No, but I have some photographs.
Okay, well, That's good, but saving all this, like listening to the old Bob Fast shows, that was amazing to me.
Yeah.
Just after he passed, it was an incredible history lesson.
unfortunately don't have tapes from years past, but about a year or two ago I started taping Bob. He was down in North Carolina at that point.
Right.
Not the height of all the juicy stuff from the archives.
But true, but he still made it special somehow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Listen, thanks for this call. Very, very enlightening.
Well,
and
thank you for being there to take it.
You're very welcome. And I look forward to many more years. Take care. And our phone line is open. It's I never gave out the phone number. 802-321-HACK. 802-321-4225. I can't believe we let that guy sit on hold for so long. Didn't know he was there. I'm sorry. So if anyone else wants to call in, we're almost at the end of this hour, and we're getting kind of tired and cranky ourselves. So if somebody does want to call, please do it now so that we can get you on and we can go about our business afterwards. 802-321-4225. But interesting points brought up about the radio station and about all kinds of See, I don't hear the phone ringing. That's why I don't know there's people on it, Kyle. Well, I told you to turn the ringer off during the other show, but okay. But how are you able to hear it? That's.
I'm just trying to keep the wheels on this wagon cart here.
Some kind of like bat hearing that you can hear a phone ringing?
I heard it in the other room.
Okay, all right. Well, let's see who's on the air. Good evening. You're on Off Hook Overtime.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to mention something that you mentioned at the beginning of the program about masks.
Okay.
And vaccinations. And the World Health Organization's suggestions to decision makers at the country level about masking does not mention at all the vaccination status of the people who are masks. It mentions whether there's community transmission or not. So with the CDC doing this, and doing that, and doing the other thing, I go with what the World Health Organization says, which if we were following their suggestions, everyone would still be masked.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have a second thing that I want to ask you about.
Okay, go ahead.
A petition that I would like your support for and the listeners' support for. AIDS for the disabled should be vaccinated. And it runs as below. I am disabled and at high risk for severe consequences or death if I were to get COVID.
Right.
I need the help of a home health care aide who is fully vaccinated. Home health care agencies claim they can't ask their aides to be vaccinated or disclose their vaccination status to me. But this isn't so. Home health care agencies are allowed to insist that all employees be vaccinated. They can ask aides to sign a confidentiality waiver to let me know the vaccination status of
mm-hmm.
an aide.
Mm-hmm.
As it is, I've not been able to get a home health care aide since January 3rd, and my need is dire. I'm only one of many vulnerable people who have the right to be assured that the help they need will, in fact, not endanger them. Although home health care agencies claim all of their aides are properly trained in how to wear masks, I've witnessed this is not so. For example, people climb the stairs and as soon as they get in the door, take off their mask to pant. They also claim that having had their temperature taken earlier in the day means they're healthy. Anyone who's actually serious about their client's safety would be willing to be vaccinated and to say so. An agency that is serious about client's safety would require this of all employees.
Mm-hmm.
Please pass whatever legislation you can to help make this happen.
Well, it's not necessarily, I mean, I support everything you're saying, and I don't think we need legislation. I think we just need these companies to establish some kind of a rule, which they have the right to do. You have the right, by the way, to say, you know, to anyone entering your home, show me proof that you're vaccinated. They don't have to show you proof. They don't have to come in. But if you become known as somebody who will not let someone in unless they have that or are willing to show that to you, I think the company might wake up and say, we're only going to send people. Go ahead.
The company is instead refused to send an aide.
then get another company.
The way you said,
right?
It is not. I'd like to give out the address of the petition so that people can sign it or can spread it.
Go right ahead.
Change.org/, and this is one word, disabled need vaccinated AIDS. AIDS is spelled AIDES.
Okay. I also suggest maybe
Let me just repeat
okay,
that.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, everybody grab a pen. Change.org/ disabled need vaccinated AIDS, AIDES, all one word.
So if I can suggest, I think you should reach out to an elected official that you think might be sympathetic to this. I'm thinking someone like AOC. You might not represent you, but still reach out to somebody that will make noise about this, because what you're saying is so logical and reasonable. Of course, that's what anybody, you know, in your situation would want and should be able to get without this kind of stress. And I think most of us are just surprised to find out that's not the case.
Thank you.
All right, well, good luck.
Is there any chance you would mention this on the air?
You know what? Send us an email. That way, oth@2600.com, and next week we'll probably be able to read it that way.
I shall.
All right, good luck.
That's
pretty unbelievable. What do you think, Alex? Alex, are you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had to unmute myself there. I think she makes a good point about this, right? And, you know, she's spreading the good word. And, I don't really know what else to say.
Well, I'm surprised. I didn't think that was the case. I just figured a home health aide would certainly be vaccinated and would be more than eager to show proof of that.
Yeah, it shows you how complicated it is, like what different people are facing.
Yeah, I mean, you get the person's name, right? And, you know, you want to know if they have an infectious disease or are likely to have an infectious disease. That's kind of important. You know, if you're Typhoid Mary and you want to help out somebody, you know, in some home someplace, it's of interest to them to know something about who you are and what you might be at risk of. Another call? Wow. How do you hear that, Kyle? I don't know how you hear that.
Bat senses.
This will be the last call because we are over the hour. Good evening.
I think there's a call. Yeah.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to make mention on the pipeline hack.
Uh-huh.
A buddy of mine that builds data centers and consolidates them said one of the big problems with something like a ransomware attack is, whereas everybody says just go to the backups, when it's been in the system for months,
right,
it's a possibility that the backups are encrypted as well.
That is true, and that's why you don't just keep one backup. You keep a backup from a year ago, you keep a backup from a month ago, you keep a backup from a week ago. And
that's only going to put back your essential programs, not anything. An example, accounts payable, accounts receivable, you know, everybody will tell you what you owe them, but they won't tell you what they owe you.
Yeah, no, good point. Very good point. There have to be other methods of redundancy, you know, of having some other form of protection. But, you know, the best one is having good security in the first place so that people aren't infesting your network. You know, that's the first
absolutely.
Step.
Absolutely. The thumb drive, etc.,
uh-huh.
Anything like that that somebody can plug into your system.
Yep, clicking on links and email.
Always
and
the possibility, the human element.
All sorts of things like that, yeah.
Okay.
There's
wanted to put out that point.
No, it was great.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Thank you for that call. Go ahead, Kyle.
That's a great point. I just thought of adding, those are some of the things you can design into your backup scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And, scheduling, maybe you have a specific type of backup and data that is done at a certain time versus a nightly backup. You know, there's different schemes and a lot of ways to strategize to just set yourself up for the best possible outcome. And like you're saying, having a clone of a backup or having a really old backup or one mid-year, all of that is up to you. You can design it however you want, but like the caller mentioned, just making something a blanket type thing, or have it be taking advantage of really fast services, or stuff that seems alluring when you want it to operate one way, that could come back to haunt you if it's operating in another way. So,
right.
Great point. In colocation and facilities that are highly capable, that can be a capability that's leveraged against your organization.
You know, you should have, I think, at least two different methods of keeping backups, maybe something in the cloud and maybe something that's local, like a DLT tape or something like that, that you have control of. Obviously, don't keep it next to the same computer you're backing up, but that way, if one system is compromised and your site goes down as well, you have something else, and so your chances increase. You know, even it's kind of weird to think this way, but the person doing the malware attack is actually making a backup for you. So that encrypted copy of your entire network or computer, whatever it is that they've attacked, if somebody that was on your side was doing that, it could actually be seen as a service. You know, if they tucked it away someplace, and if you needed access to it, here's the password. You have access to it. Maybe there's a cottage industry that can be formed in going out and doing friendly ransomware attacks and notifying people, this is how we got in, and this is where your data is. Don't let it happen again. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's certainly one way of referring to a breach, which is would be something like, you know, an unscheduled backup to the cloud. a euphemism for getting screwed.
Well, and my question, I think, with a backup having been affected would be, how functionally was that generated if the very system itself was disabled and taken over by some kind of shell or operating system that's running in memory, encrypting everything, and presumably some functionality that would deteriorate, and I don't know, like, how that is highly specific to exactly what kind of attack your machines are being subject to. But one other trick too is having different types of machines, having a little bit more diversity, if you can possibly swing that, will also increase, I think, your chances of having a good outcome. But there's a lot to consider.
I think that's a good closing for us. And this might be the longest overtime ever, because it's now 7 minutes after 9 o'clock. Wow. An hour and 7 minutes. So any last words, Alex?
No, I'm pretty tired. I think it's been a fun, long show. And we'll see everyone next week.
Again, write to us, oth@2600.com. Contribute to BAI if you can. Give to WBAI.org. And write to us, oth, as I said, at 2600.com. And we will see you next week. Good night.